Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and as always, I'm joined by, hey, Milkation Island is empty. Someone's moved into the parlor. Danielle Caroli.
I have arrived and literally got off the flight, came home, went to the barn, and started milking. So, milkation is over. I am back in the swing of things here.
It's awesome. Are you excited to be back in the parlor?
It's actually really nice because it's still only one goat, and it probably takes me all of 5 more minutes to milk her. So I'm really much easing in this year. I have a few more weeks until I have a few more does due. And so it's very much a nice, easy entrance into our 2022 milking season.
Well, congratulations again. Now when I'm saying I'm doing chores, I'm like, well, so is she. So, meh.
Exactly.
But yeah, we next week don't have a guest lined up, so I think it'll be a nice topic week. So maybe we'll save some of our kidding season stories for next week.
That sounds great to me.
All righty. Well, Danielle, we have a guest.
Yes, we do. I'm really excited for this guest. I was telling him earlier while we were doing research, we did a little bit of digging to figure out what is the story behind this guest. And I feel that we are going to have a wonderful conversation with some awesome stories shared today.
I agree. I mean, everybody listening probably knows this guest. For one of two reasons, either through his work as a judge or his work with people of Nepal. But regardless of how you know his passion is goats. Dan Laney is a longtime ADCA judge and has judged many past national shows, including the 2021 show in Louisville. His judging reputation precedes him, and his judging signature is his ability to remember every single kid's name during a showmanship class. At the 2021 ADCA convention, Dan was awarded the Helen Hunt Distinguished Service Award for his dedication to giving back, particularly through the Worldwide Goat Project Nepal, where he works with the people of Nepal to teach goat husbandry and ensure successful and often life-changing goat ownership to the people in rural Nepal. Welcome to the show, Daniel Laney.
Well, thank you very much, John and Danielle. It's really great to be here.
I'm super excited to have you on. I mean, you're kind of like ADCA's sweetheart, right? Everybody loves you. You always have a smile on your face, and it's just the passion is always there. So I'm super excited.
Well, thank you. And it's likewise for me. Anytime I get to talk with some friends about goats, you know, I'm all for it. So I'm looking forward to today's episode myself.
Awesome. Well, we do. I want to get through some ADCA news real quick, Dan, before we get into our conversation, if that's all right. And it's been a light week, everybody, or a couple weeks, I guess. Postal ballots have passed for approval of the stamp duplicate extension through September. So we all knew that was coming. And then, the postal ballot for linear appraisal changes has been approved. So I know that's a hot button topic, but we're going to leave it at that.
And if anybody wants to see what those postal ballot approval changes for linear appraisal are, they can be viewed on the ADGA website.
Yep. And I believe we've shared that link too on our Facebook page.
I think it's on our Facebook page, and then it's probably on our website as well in our resource section under at dairygoatpodcast.com. I think it's resources. There's a link there. But if Perfect. There's not, I will have it up for you all.
Perfect. Well, let's move right into the main topic, our guest. I'm super excited. Dan, for those that may not know who you are, can we hear about you and how you got started in Dairy Goats?
Sure. Well, let's see. I'll start with how, you know, I started with this whole Dairy Goat passion of mine. I had three children, and my second son, or actually my wife had the three children. We our second child was lactose intolerant. And so we started off with Josh was born in 1972. And so we ended up going through an isomil stage where we had an isomil as a formula that was something recommended by the doctor as an alternative to, you know, once he got through nursing mom. And we both kind of like opened a can of isomil at that time, and it had a funky smell. And I went, I don't know. I just don't know about this. Let's look a little deeper. And I happened to come upon an old copy of Mother Earth News. This was a copy that was, of course, back in the old day, black and white, newsprint kind of the magazine. And in there, it talked about dairy goats. And the milk was the best alternative to mother's milk. So I proceeded to look in the paper, and I found a Nubian Alpine cross doe called Tiger Lily, who had just kitted, and the owners were traveling to a place where they couldn't keep her. And so they had her for sale, and I bought her for $40. I had a Rambler station wagon at the time and was teaching in a one-room schoolhouse up in Northern California. And I had to haul her in the back of my Rambler station wagon for about 65 miles.
And, oh, my gosh. And
I put all the back down flat so she could just kind of stand on the back part. And that goat put her head over my shoulder and looked out the front window with me. And we just bonded on the way going home. And she never made a mess in the car. She didn't do anything. And that was it. And so I knew I had found something that was just like gold to me. And so whenever we went through the process of getting, you know, finding out how to milk and do all that kind of stuff, because it was just a learn through the instruction book kind of a deal, and talk to a couple people around that I knew, I got that milk out of Tiger Lily, and my wife looked at the milk and said, okay, before we feed that to our little one, I want you to drink it for a while and see what it does to you. So, I went, okay. And of course, I really had never had goat's milk before that I could recall, but I was brave and had to put on a good face. So I took the milk and drank it. And she looked at me and I looked at her and she goes, how is it? And I went, and anyway, the milk was delicious, and that was it. And so we now, our son Josh is a practicing school psychologist, and I tell him he owes it all to Tiger Lily. So that kind of got me started with goats. And what I decided from Tiger Lily was that I had actually was studying to be a veterinarian early on before I went into teaching, and had shown or had judged on the livestock judging team. And so I was, you know, kind of aware of, you know, the qualities of livestock and whatnot. So I decided if I was going to have goats, because Tiger Lily was a sure fit for me, that I wanted to have good goats. And so then I kind of got interested in the registered stock, and that kind of took on a life of its own.
So what was your herd name, and what breeds did you raise raising registered stock?
Yep. Great. When I decided to get into registered stock, I had taken a year and went to live in Alaska and taught school to the Tlingit Indians up in Alaska on an island, Sitka, for a year. And so we had to go back to the isomil, and that was just torture. And so as soon as we got back in the States after 1 year, we decided we were going to find a place where we could have the goats. And so I looked around, and I found out at that time there was a breed that, or a herd that was down in Southern California called Hacienda. And so I went and I was able to locate a couple does from that breed or that herd. And my herd name, because we lived on a mountaintop and basically a cabin at this time in Northern California, was Slinker Ridge, S-L-I-N-K-E-R Ridge, because the place we lived on was Slinker Ridge. And I raised Nubians. We started off with Nubians and then branched out. And over the years, had Alpines as well as La Manchas.
Wow. So rumor has it, you've bred some pretty amazing animals too. I mean, you've also bred a national champion. And who was she?
Okay, well, I actually had... had several national champions. The first one that I had was, her name was Mount Shasta Villa. And actually she was a La Mancha. And I had acquired her from one of my 4-H kids as a young doe that was going on to school. And I helped to help her with her college education. And she helped me with introducing me to La Manchas through this Mount Shasta Villa. And I was able to, you know, do the things that I could do, and she did what she had to do. And actually, she became the first 2 times national champion La Mancha that we had in ADCA at that time.
Wow.
And so that was she was just an incredible doe and always has a special spot in my heart. And then at the same time that was going on, I was still raising my Nubians, and I had a Nubian doeling that I had bred and raised myself as far as in my herd name. And her name was Slinker Ridge Mobandi. And she was the junior national champion Nubian in 1989 at the LA National Show. And then she was sold the next year in the Colorama sale at Douglas, Wyoming. And that was the year that Avia won her second national champion. So in 1989, had the junior national champion Nubian, and then also the national champion La Mancha. And that was a year I'll never forget for sure.
That's pretty awesome and special, that's for sure.
Yeah, it certainly was. And then as the years went on, I had a partner, Karen Sen, and then the two of us also had a huge number, but from my own herd, those were the ones that I had that really were a big inspiration for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's that's a big milestone for any breeder. I mean, I saw a post earlier this week on Facebook of somebody that had been breeding goats for 40 years and decided to retire, and you know, they were so happy with their herd, and the one thing they said was, yeah, we bred 40 years and we never did get that national champion, but we bred some darn nice goats.
So. Yep. Yeah. Oh no, it takes a lot of work, and it's all the timing. It's a lot of things. You could have, you know, a very strong herd and actually, you know, a herd that lasts like over the 40 years as a person you're talking about and has consistent quality animals, man, that's, you know, that says it all right there as well.
Right. So, yeah.
I have great admiration. And for those people who have that longevity with quality animals, no matter if they get the top ring or not, it doesn't really, you know, necessarily mean that they're not as good as those who are national champions.
Right. Yeah, I agree 100%. So speaking of, you know, nationals and ADCA and show goats, you're an ADCA judge. And when did you decide to become a judge?
Actually, it was really kind of one of those funny things. You know, for myself, I had, you know, I had been on the judging team, like I said, at school and college, but we didn't have goats, of course, on our judging team. But, you know, you could apply those same kind of a lot of the same qualities or characteristics that they look for in other breeds, livestock, to the goats in general, especially obviously with the dairy cattle. But what really got me going, I was showing at a county fair, and then I went to one of my first shows, and it really intrigued me about, you know, how the whole process worked with judging goats. And I was impressed with the fact that the judge couldn't just pick an animal and put him up front and then go on. They had to actually give reasons as to why the animal, you know, deserved in their mind to be where they were placed. Mm-hmm. And as a breeder and as somebody interested in really kind of, you know, improving my herd and trying to do as much as I could for the goat industry, even back then, I got to thinking, you know, that's a really good asset to have. I really need to get a little more knowledge about this. So I decided first to just take the licensing as an auditor, just to kind of get the information. I was just going to use it for my own personal, you know, benefits as a breeder. So I audited the training conference in Washington State in 1975. And it was an interesting experience, I have to say. Pretty dramatic as far as for the candidates who were going to try to go through the license. And we had the whole gamut of emotions being expressed throughout the time. And I'm going, boy, this is pretty heavy duty. I'm glad I'm just kind of auditing it. But it really, I got my feet into the water and decided I wanted to go further with it. And so then in 1976, I went and actually got my first license. And so that was a really exciting, I'll never forget that. As they say, when you become a licensed judge and it's that first license you get, it's like, I couldn't sleep that night. I just could not sleep that night, just thinking the whole time, oh my gosh, I am now a licensed ADCA judge. It was like I'd been a father, I'd been a school superintendent, had all these things. But this was like also one of those real key moments in my life as well.
It never changed. It definitely is a milestone. I'll give you that for sure. And then talking about judging, when you're at a goat show, yes, John and I have both seen you judge, and you just exude happiness and you're one of the judges who we can all see that you're enjoying yourself out there judging. And can you talk a little bit about where that passion comes from?
Well, for myself, it's like, number one, I really have a great deal of, I really want to honor the whole aspect of being a judge. It's like something that, I take quite seriously, even though like sometimes I kid around and joke. It's something that I feel is really important for exhibitors to have the best set of eyes on their goats as possible. And it's only one person's opinion and all of those kinds of things. But for me, the second I get into the ring, part of what happens is just the energy that is in that ring, the people that are there, and the fact that I have the opportunity to look at these wonderful animals that are coming in the ring and kind of sort through them, pick the one that I kind of like and stack them in the order that I feel, and then have to give meaningful and understandable reasons as to why I've done that. And the whole point is, again, to try to help educate and further those people who are in that ring with their animals a little bit more, to give them some information that perhaps will help them on their path so that, you know, they can learn and pick up some pointers about their goats as they compare to others. But it's just something, like I said, it takes place with this whole interaction. I get the energy from the people in the ring, and I cannot tell you what happens. I mean, it's just it's just something that comes from within, and it's just a joy. It's just a pure joy that I have of being there, and not in the sense that, boy, am I going to have fun telling you what I think. It's like, coming from like, I really want to support. I appreciate what you're doing. And still, we all need to learn. And we all are trying to, we all want to have some ideas of how to get better.
Right.
And if I can do anything in that way and help a person and also let them know that I really value them because of what they're trying to do and are doing. It's kind of all that, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I'll never forget. I was doing a judge's training over Zoom. It was kind of a pre-judges training workshop that they put on a few years ago. And one of the instructors said that really resonated and is resonating as you're talking about it too, is that while we may be judges, our job really isn't to judge. It is to appreciate. We are never, as the way that ADGA scorecard is structured and how we are told to give reasons, we are never there to criticize or be judgy, I want to say, is the best word. Yeah. But we are there to appreciate. And so when you look at it that way, I definitely think there's a change in perspective.
In delivery and all that, I don't know. You're absolutely right. Because I think that going back to earlier, your question, John, too, is that you asked me kind of what got into judging. And, you know, I think part of it was that I had an experience many years ago with a judge who was like that, who was just really negative and critical. Everybody in the ring kind of walked away with kind of a bad taste in their mouth. And really, even if the judging was accurate, you really walked away with like, I don't know, it loses its effectiveness. That's all.
Yeah. Nobody wants to hear in the ring, are these backyard goats, anything like negative like that.
Right. I mean, and you can't just sugarcoat everything, but at the same time, there's a way you can deliver it so that it's a meaningful conversation.
Right.
I think that, to me, I just think it's critical. While you're being accurate, while you're doing all the things you should do, you have to have that level of respect and appreciation for the people who are there.
Yeah, I agree. And, last year, you were able to judge on the big stage at Nationals. You judged Nigerians, Alpines, and Oberhausley. So we know it wasn't your first time judging Nationals, but how does judging at Nationals differ from judging at other shows, if it does?
Well, number one, I have to say that it's always, for me personally, it's still a huge honor to be, because one of the things that happens, as we know, it's a selection process. And so you're being selected by your peers, and to have that affirmation, number one, that you are, well thought of and have some credibility as a judge, that the peers select you, that is one of the highest honors you can get as a judge, in my mind, because we're talking about across the board. So just the very fact that you're on that stage, number one, is huge as far as, your just being honored and respected as a judge. I cannot tell you, though, when I talk about the joy that happens with me when I'm in a ring and the energy that comes about when I'm in a ring and I'm talking about even a small little county fair, it's there. It is multiplied 25,000 times when you're at the national show. It is like, and I'm saying that from a perspective of having shown at many national shows as well, and know what it's like to be an exhibitor from that standpoint and coming in the ring and then having been the judges on the other side and judging. And it is just, it's a thrill that is can't be measured in very many other ways. The difference is that I think that you have to be very clear about what you're looking for. And you have to also have a certain level of rhythm, because you're looking at, like, we had a class this last time at the Nationals, which wasn't large as far as some of the previous national entries. But I'm just thinking of the two-year-old Nigerian dwarf class. There were like 80 milking does in there. They just kept coming in, even though there were Nigerians smaller size, they filled that ring up. And I can remember just seeing them coming and coming and coming. But there were so many beautiful animals, and it just elevates you. So I think you have to really be, clear. You have to really keep focused on what it is you're looking for. And then you have to make sure you can articulate it back to the exhibitor and those observing the show. And, you're videoed, you're recorded. So those things are even more critical, I think, at a national show. But the joy, the thrill, it's beyond measure.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. And you mentioned that big class, And that's like kind of like an iconic picture from last year. It's just from different angles from all these people that were there posting on Facebook, just all these animals. It's like a sea of beautiful Nigerians. And you two just looking them over. I'm like, man, that had to be daunting.
Well, it was a really tough go. But you know, one of the things I mentioned to my wonderful, supportive, and delightful cohort, Annie McKeever, I got to mention Annie. She was just, it was a real mm-hmm. thrill to be working with her at Nationals. And we're talking, they all were great, all of the breeds, but just this particular one I'm just thinking of now. And that is in that class. And she said, oh my gosh, we have 80. How are we going to do this? And I said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to bring them in and line them up in groups of 20. We'll have four rows of 20, and then we'll start selecting from those, and we'll end up with 20 at the top. And she said, oh, okay. I get it. But, it was not quite that simple, I can tell you that, because you want to make sure you don't overlook. And I have to be honest with you. There is no way that a person can say, I didn't miss a thing. In a class of 80, you're bound to, there's something you're going to miss occasionally. There's no question about it. I'm not saying that that's what should happen, but that can very easily happen. But mm-hmm. the idea is to minimize any of those misses and to make sure that your eye is on the prize and keen as can be. And, but by going through the steps like that, sorting, it happens. And it's a doable process.
Perfect. Yeah. Hats off to you, because that's that was something. Now,
yes.
For those that don't know, you have a background both in education and have not only worked as an educator, but you also worked with or for Patty Dean of Willow Run fame. When did you work there, and what was that experience like?
Oh boy, that was one I didn't have down in my book as far as the dates. I have to tell you, I have to think about that for a little bit. Let's see, 90s. It was in the 90s, and so okay. like that. And so the experience was, I came into working with Willow Run as a sales manager, and we had been good friends, and I had just finished a stint of being the secretary treasurer, office manager of Adkin Spindale. I had the great experience of having been a director of California, the past president of ADCA, and then also serving on as an office manager as an interim while we were hiring a permanent office manager. And so that process ended, and we had a permanent office manager. And so I was leaving Spindale, and then the deans were building up their commercial side of their business with their product, and they wanted to add on to their sales team. And so I decided that I would love to go and try to be a help with that process. And so I had originally was born in Ohio, so I kind of came back to my roots in a sense, even though it wasn't exactly in the same location. I was born and raised up, or not raised, but born in Warren, Ohio. And that's the northeast corner, and they were in Dayton. But anyway, I went there and started working on as a salesperson, and had not really been, in a sales position like that before. One thing that I took away from that, though, was it had to make cold calls to get set up, because we were doing demos in stores, health food stores, grocery stores that had larger deli sections. And my territory was the whole northeast from Mississippi River. All east, the whole area. And so I was pretty well given full rein to call and make the setups of the presentations that I wanted. And you call and say, I'd like to bring some goat milk product to the store. And say, and anyway, one of the things, and you get a lot of no's, we're not interested, thank you, goat's milk, goat product, no. But I read a book, and it was like, hey, listen, it's statistical, it has been shown that every fourth call will be a yes. So what you need to do is, instead of feeling bad about saying, you know, somebody telling you no, look at it as it's one step closer to a yes. And it was like, that flipped my whole mind. So whenever somebody say, no, we're not interested, I say, okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Get on to the next one, because that was one step closer to that yes. And that flipped it. And that just, anyway, it turned out that over a short time, we were able to get the dairy into the black by the large numbers of sales that were generated. And that was a real, I felt a positive thing for me. Unfortunately, the other things took place and the dairy was dismantled. But as far as that experience, it was a really rewarding one for helping to get the public interested and acquainted with dairy goat products. That was what I see from that time. Mm. And it became, it just was one more little room in my house of things that I've
exactly
to do with sure. the goats. And so that kind of helped set the stage for really recognizing and pushing the benefits of goat's milk.
Yeah, awesome. So moving into what we really wanted to talk about.
Oh yeah, this was all peripheral. This was all peripheral.
What is the Worldwide Goat Project Nepal?
Okay, so I'm going to give everybody a hint. Now, just hold on to your seat because this could take this is really going to trip a trigger with me. All the other stuff was just kind of like ingredients. This is kind of a frosting on the cake. But the Worldwide Goat Project Nepal is what I currently, outside of my family and the judging, have set as my top priority. And so what it involves is it's kind of like a one-man bag. I kind of see myself as a Johnny Appleseed, but of the goat world of Nepal. And so I'm kind of like going around delivering goats and talking about goats all over the country of Nepal. But it's my project, and it's I've been able to be continued due to the wonderful encouragement, support, everything of all of my wonderful goat friends that are out there in your audience. And I cannot thank them enough for helping provide the mechanism for me to keep doing what I love doing.
It's pretty impressive what you are doing. And can we kind of go over the project and how it all came about and how many years you've been doing it? And
sure. I'd love to. Okay. So first, I went to Nepal for the first time in 1990. And it was something that just was always on my little list. I grew up in Ohio, like I said, and a large part of my time was spent in Ohio. And I was in fifth grade at a school, and I remember looking at the world map, and I was on a little farm and just a little farm kid, and looked at the world map and I saw this place called Kathmandu, and then it had this Mount Everest next to it. And so I went to my teacher and I said, oh, when I grow up, I'm going to go to Kathmandu. That just is a place I want to visit. And I remember the teacher looked at me and said, oh, Daniel, you're just a little farm kid from Ohio. You're not going to go to a place like Kathmandu in Nepal. And it just always kind of stuck with me. And she wasn't really being critical, but she just couldn't see that in her line of vision for me. But it always stuck with me. And as I, you know, got older and all that, and I decided in 1989, I had packed a backpack, and I had my 45th birthday and decided to take a little trip. My kids were all set up, and so I put on my backpack, and I took 2 weeks off, and I went to Thailand, and met a British colonel, and his name was Colonel Paul Gay, and his wife and family. And they happened to live with a military base stationed in Pokhara, Nepal. And we visited on this island for a couple of days. And he said, hey, some American who's traveling around with a backpack, come over and see us in Nepal. And I go, Nepal? I said, do I have to go to Kathmandu to get to your place? And he goes, everybody has to go to Kathmandu. I said, I'm on my way. So 1990, I took my first trip. And then I just fell in love with the country. And that continued over the years. So that, and I would go whenever I could to just kind of visit. I called it my like centering place. I'd go for even a, if I could only go for a couple weeks and just kind of visit different spots each time. And I just kept falling more and more in love with the culture and the people. And the, of course, the country itself is just magical. And so that continued for a number of years. And then what happened was I went through a couple rough times, I'd say. Like in 2011, I went to Peru and I was going to climb Machu Picchu and ended up, there was some problems with the trail being washed out. And I picked up a virus in Cusco, came home, and I ended up getting sick and was in a coma in the hospital for a month.
Oh, wow. And,
oh, my goodness.
They could not figure out what was going on with me. They had, I had 47 cultures. The cultures got contaminated. And after 28 days, I was strapped in the bed down to nothing. And they said there's nothing more they could do. And that's whenever this whole other thing took place, in that I was basically given an opportunity to come back without going into great details. I was on my, really, the monitors were going mm-hmm. down. And so anyway, I had given an opportunity and I saw a vision in my head as I was laying there of all my goat friends that I've known over the years. And I looked at them walking towards me and I said, I'm coming. And I came back out of the coma. And so then from then on, I decided wow. I was given a new life. And there's a little more details about all of it, but that's basically what happened. And I was given this opportunity for a new life. And I said, man, I am not going to squander it. And so I first took care of my mom, who was 92. And she, after 6 months, she had had cancer. And so she passed away. And then I really was in a dilemma what to do, because I was still kind of coming out from this whole coma experience and then having mm-hmm. lost her suddenly. And my one son said, Dad, you know what you do? You pick up the pieces and put all the stuff together that you love and then take it off. And I mean, take off from there. So I thought, okay, I love people. I love goats. I love Nepal and I love teaching. Oh, and I had taken time off to take care of mom and I hadn't been to Nepal for a couple years. So I decided I was going to go back to Nepal, but not as a visitor, but to really get engaged to do more, because it had given me so much. And so I decided in my mom's name, I would develop this Worldwide Goat Project Nepal. And that kind of, it started out originally what I was going to do was try to bring semen from some of our goats here and cross them with the local breed and improve the goats that they had. Mm-hmm. And then in the course of that time, I came upon a herd that unbeknown to me at that time, during that time frame when I was in the coma and all that, two people, Helen Snyder, Daniel Constantine, had actually sent goats through the World Bank project that was funded during that time period to Nepal. And it was the first and only shipment of goats like that that was sent into that country. And they sent 50 sonnens, and then there were 50 boars that some people from Australia rounded up and sent there. And so when I started, I was in Nepal and I was talking to the Ministry of Agriculture about the semen project. And it was getting a little bit difficult to get the semen imported into Nepal. I decided, why don't I work with the goats that are here and try to do something with these sonnens to make sure that they stay viable while mm-hmm. I work with other goats? And so that turned the whole thing around. And that's what really, the next day I talked to one of the ministers at the livestock division in Kathmandu. They put me on a bus. Then I got off at about 75 miles down the road and got on the back of a motorbike and rode up 15 kilometers to the top of this mountain and found
the sonnens. Oh my goodness.
and that started this whole new course for me. And so that was in, I think 2015, I mean, 2015. So 2014, it was 2014 that when that started. So for the last 8 years, I have been really involved with this, and I call it the Worldwide Go Project Nepal. And so it has many different levels, and it's taken on a life of its own in a sense over the years. But I work with the government. They have the Dasanans in a place called the National Goat Research Project in Bandipur, Nepal. And we keep a viable herd of purebred Sanans and purebred boars there. And then we have crossed them with the local breeds and are increasing both the meat and milk production of the local breeds of goats that they have. And started introducing cheese there. And so we have a large tourist attraction under normal times. And so there's the cheese aspect that really helps to add profit to their the viability of the goats in the country. And I support the Women's Skills Development Project, which is in Pokhara, that make the little goats. And I work in the schools as well, and we do art projects in the schools. And so we've helped fund some art students in Nepal and Kathmandu as they progress through their learning and the art education. And then I do sessions up in the villages where I actually try to use sustainable practices using materials that are available to the village farmers to help increase the husbandry practices in a positive manner for their goats. And then I donate female goats to the farmers that are in need of the goats, and they do a chain where they give their first female goat to another farmer. So,
oh, wow.
That's amazing.
And it just keeps, you know, it like I said, it keeps rippling out. I'm still, and what I found is I go back to the villages though, because you have to really have it be sustainable. You can't do a one-time shot. You just can't come in and blah, 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 and then leave and never come back. It's just not going to stick. It's just
right.
It dries out. And so I try to circle back while I'm always adding a little bigger sphere in another village. I still go back to my original ones and touch base with them and see how they're doing and, you know, make the little adjustments or whatever that needs to be done. And it's just this last year, we were able to add a whole nother concept where I teamed up with some other NGOs, and those are non-government organizations. And we were able to sponsor a health clinic at a rural school that had 254 students. And we had doctors and dentists up there doing screenings and giving medicines to these kids. And it was just so exciting while I was doing the little goat distribution and presentations over here with the adults.
Yeah. So it's not just goats. There's definitely more to this program, even though, you know, it's under the Worldwide Goat Project Nepal. It definitely seems like it is all encompassing, and you're bringing both kind of all spheres of your life together. I mean, between your educational background, your passion for goats, all of this you're bringing to these people, your passion for travel. And it just seems like a wonderful combination. And obviously you created this, but it was the fit for you to really do something for everyone. And so really quick,
yes.
With your educational background, were you doing any agricultural instruction before this, or was it just the perfect culmination?
Well, primarily, you know, I was 4-H leaders and things like that. But as far as anything, you know, beyond that, no. I just, you know, it's always preaching about goat's milk where I went.
Right.
Because of the outcome that I have with my son. And so, but no, this really kind of just brought it all together. And so now, you know, along with this, I do trainings for farmer to farmer and USAID over there in some villages as well. But it's all this connectivity with the goats. And one of the things that just has, I just want to say is that, with this aspect of this project, what I try to do is I try to post pictures when I'm on my trip to Nepal and kind of keep people abreast of what's going on, because I've been fortunate in the sense that I've had my goats, I've raised my herds, I had national champion. I still am able to connect with people through judging, but I don't have my own farm goats, so that I'm not tied to the, you know, the milking like all of, you know, most of my friends are. And so when I travel, I try to share my experiences with them so they can, you know, like vicariously be traveling with me to Nepal, and I feel their presence with me when I'm over there. So I send these pictures back and say, okay, now we're here, we're doing this. And that's been a really great way for me to feel connected with my friends here in the US, which really, I do this for all of us. You know what I mean? We're all in this together.
Yeah, it's, I love the updates when you're out there, just seeing all those cool sites that you see. And also, you know, you showing the ladies making the goats and the goat husbandry teachings that you're giving everybody. I mean, it's pretty impressive.
That's all right, John. You take
if the people of Nepal only learned one thing from your travels and you teaching them all aspects of goats, what is that one thing you hope that is?
Well, the one thing that, you know, they have a great appreciation for goats because there's millions of them in Nepal, and they don't eat cow. So they do use the goat meat, you know, as a viable source of protein. And so they're really a value to the Nepalese people. The one thing that, so they have a value already, but one of the things that added value that I'd like them to think about is to make sure that they look at them as, and they give them, you know, three things, basically. It's not just one thing, but three things. They give them fresh water all the time. I mean, they have to have fresh water 24/7, and that sometimes is not quite the case. That they need to keep watch on the inbreeding, so they separate males and females, so they have some healthy goats. And the third thing is to keep the feed up off the ground so that they can help reduce parasite infection. And I see that happening, and I see it happening more and more in so many ways, and that doesn't cost much money at all to do any one of those. And right. So that is what I'd like to do, is, you know, encourage them to continue their own love of the goat, but to help improve those conditions that make them even healthier.
No, that's very cool. And just kind of a random tangent on that, or not so random, but you were talking about the goats that are there. How do they differ from the goats we see in the United States?
Okay, well, one of the things that I was thinking about along that line is they are a little smaller because they, you know, have to be as efficient as possible. The Kari goat is the native goat of Nepal. There's seven, but the Kari goat is the most common. They used to be called the hill goat, and they are in the most moderate range, like from 1,000 to 4,000 feet elevation. Or 5,000 feet elevation is where they kind of range as a rule. But they're a little smaller. They would be similar to the Kiko goat, but they are primarily a meat goat. And so they are – one of the things that we have found is that the Kari goat is very resistant to enterotoxemia. So it's like they don't have CD&T vaccinations available, but the Kari goat – does not have a high mortality problem from NRO to begin with. And so by crossing the Kari with the Sonnen goats that have in the boars, because that was a major problem, we've been able to help improve that hybrid vigor, and the mortality rate has been reduced naturally. But they're just a real hardy goat. One of the things that I think is also interesting is Nepal, as a rule, is that in villages primarily, they have commercial farms, but in villages, they have the household farms, and the goat shed is right next to the house. So the goats are really gentle, and they're a part of the whole family lifestyle. They're like they're really truly like a family dog, and they are right there. So the goats just wonder where they know where they're supposed to go. It's just a
Can we bring that trait into the United States? Because
I know, especially with some breeds, it would really be helpful with it. I guess we're talking about the disposition, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah, if they just weren't quite so curious at my barn, we would have a lot easier life. But
well, I mean, I can remember when I first went over there, truly, I was thinking, my goodness, they're going to just be running all over the hills. How do they even control that? Well, they just walk with the people. I don't know. It's just something that's in there, and that's something I've noticed and I really appreciate. But the Kari is a really hardy goat.
Yeah. Okay. Now, as you're meeting and teaching and befriending all of these people halfway around the world, what are some of the things that they have taught you?
Oh, man, that goes on. That's a tremendous list. They have taught me a great deal. Number one, it just says further enhanced extreme flexibility and durability of the goat. I mean, I've traveled to like 40 countries or more, and the goats are everywhere and that I've gone. And they're in all different climates, all different areas. All, you know, the goats are such a connection that it just has intensified that whole feeling of a respect for the goat as an animal, and how just really magnificent they are in the sense that they provide meat, milk, hide, companionship, fertilizer, you know, the list goes on and on. And the farmers have learned how to make the best advantage of all those areas. And one of the things that I've learned is that they're so practical with practical and inventive with the way in which they have to operate over there due to the limited resources that they have, especially financial resources or medical resources. So like, for example, they build their barns with slatted flooring, and all the droppings go beneath the barn. And then many times they'll build it on a hillside. And so the flooring kind of like juts out, and, you know, so there's like a slope underneath the barn, and all the droppings will run down, and they'll have a trench, and the trench will be there, and that'll catch all the droppings. And they use that then for the fertilizer in their kitchen gardens right there, or their larger fields.
Right.
They have the pens are cleaner, and they don't have to worry so much about, you know, all that. So that's one thing that I've learned about it. I've learned also just how to, you know, use the different forages that they have to use, and they know which forages the goats will eat and won't eat. And, I guess I've learned how they have become very inventive about using the resources that they have available, and just open my mind up to the fact that there's a lot of different ways to raise goats.
Mm-hmm.
Our way.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, and even we see that here. One breeder can do something and have success, and another breeder can copy to a T, and it wouldn't work for them. And
yep.
It is a universal truth,
right?
To yep. Goat husbandry, well, I think.
I'm just thinking, and they have these goat herders have a connection that is just awesome to watch. One of the, just quickly on this particular thing, which was a pleasure for me, is I was able to, on my last trip where we did it was just a great trip overall. Everything it was just wonderful, but the school process. But then there was a farmer that I'd known for a number of years. And this is the beauty of having gone back many years. I kind of have a lot of different connections in different places. And I come upon this farmer a while back that was doing a great job raising his goats. And he had mixed boar, sonnen, Kari cross goats. And anyway, he decided he was going to relocate because his son was an engineer in Australia, and that was the only child they had, and they were going to sell out. So he was selling his herd out, and I found out about it, and I wanted to get a couple of those animals for a village that I wanted to bring in new bloodlines to, because they had been using the same bucks pretty routinely over the years. And okay. I wanted to bring these animals in, not only with some bucks and does, to help, you know, give them a good infusion of new genetics. And so it took quite a bit to get all that organized, because one thing is travel in Nepal, it's difficult at best. And anyway, in travel.
Right. Well, you, as you said, you were on a motorbike to get up the mountain for your first trip.
And I had a backpack and my computer in this case. And it was like, where am I going? We were able to bring these goats from this farm in one place of Nepal, and quite an 8-hour drive over very rugged road, mountainous roads, to spot that I've been working with, in this place called Bumimata. The lady who I wanted to get the goats to house first, like my first staging place, before I give them out into the rest of the village, she had a really nice setup there, but she had some problems with her knees, and it was a concern. She was, it was a concern with her family whether she could take care of the goats. And her barn, when I got the goats there, the barn had steps down to the loafing place. There were steps. And so we had to get these goats out of the back of the truck, get them down the steps, and then they were down with the other goats. She had 5 or 6 other goats. And so we said, okay. And she goes, okay, so in the morning, I'll get them up and put them out there. Well, I'm thinking all night, I was sleeping in one place there, and I'm thinking, oh, she's got to bring all those, well, there's 5 of these new ones, 5 new goats up those steps and outside, and she has those bad knees. Oh my gosh. And I'm getting up early. I'm going to get down there. So I woke up at 5 o'clock. I went down there. She had all those goats out where she stakes. She does this deal where she stakes them in her particular place with a hobble on a post. She had all those goats out there, and they were just standing there looking at her. And I said, you know, Samana, how did you do that? She goes, I just talked to them. They followed me. And I'm going,
oh my God.
And there was a 3-year-old buck. He was huge. And he just was this, you know, I was just floored. And it was just, yeah. So I don't know. There's a connection there.
Yeah, no, there really is. Here I was thinking she was going to have some like superwoman moment and bring these animals up the stairs, and you're just going to be like, no, let me help you. And no, she just had that connection, that magical kind of goat herder connection.
Right. And so I've learned that I think, you know, if you really... And you know, we have it too, right? Got that heart. If you have that heart and you really, there's some animals that you can communicate with, and some you go, okay, I think maybe you're better at a different farm.
Exactly.
But you know, we have those connections ourselves. I had that with my, with one of, certainly with Avia, that national champion.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's a joy. I don't know. I'm sorry. I kind of rambled along here. But,
no, that was a great story.
It's just really great to be able to share some of those little things with you and in the audience here. And I again want to thank you.
Oh yeah.
No, that was so. We wanted to ask you, and I mean that's why you're on, so we can hear these kind of things. We heard, you know, herds from moving animals 8 hours away. If you were to kind of give a rough estimate, what has been the total impact in Nepal of this program? Roughly how many villages have you been working with, or how many goats have kind of been under the Dan Laney influence?
Well, it's kind of, you know, it's a little bit hard to kind of parse it out in a sense, but just real quickly, like say at Bandipur, that is the National Goat Research Station. Okay. So they have like, they have a total of about 600 goats there, and they, it's a training and breeding program, kind of a facility, but, I've been working with them, like I said, for 7 years, and I could comfortably say hundreds of goats, as far as we've been able to keep the Sonnen purebred herd viable. And from head down to as low as 17 of the original goats, we now have like over 75 purebred Sonnens there on site, not counting probably 100 that we've parsed out to villages over the years. So, I mean, that's been one thing. In the villages numbers, I would say it varies. I have... been to probably 20 villages over the course of this period of time. And like I say, I kind of keep circling and just bring in another 2 or 3. I've actually been to many villages, but to actually have an impact and been there. I would say it's been around 20 villages. The goat distributions that I've been able to help facilitate, it's not as many as I would like to say that I've been able to do, but I would comfortably 45 or 50 goats that I have personally placed, and then not counting their offsprings that have happened since that time.
That's awesome. That's great.
It's just been because, you know, it takes time to get them to different places. I want to make sure that I get the healthy goats from farmers that I've worked with, because what I do is I try to keep it all in Nepal. I go and I work with the farmers. If they follow the practices, then I'll go back and I'll talk to them about getting goats from them at their price that they get for their goats, that I can then take to another village and then for a training session as a after, you know, part of the training, donate those goats to a new village. And that takes a little coordination. And so, you know, and I want to keep the quality up. But the word has spread. And one of the things that's really great, though, is, again, back to all of those areas, whether it's a single village or whether it's at that goat research station that I spend a lot of time with, they have visitors. In the goat research station, because it's a national facility, there's hundreds of farmers and young students from agricultural colleges that visit that site weekly. I mean, literally hundreds of busloads come.
Wow.
And they visit and they see all that's going on. So anything that we do there, like just recently, last trip, I instituted actual mineral feeders that I was able to put together from PVC piping.
Mm-hmm. And,
but those kinds of things are seen by these farmers. It's in a Nepalese setting. They're seeing it's being done and they can see the results, and that spreads it out like wildfire to the other villages.
Right. Yeah. They go home and they're like, I saw this and yeah, we could do this.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, it's using stuff that's there that they can have their hands on. One of the things I just want to tell you as far as a little story, if I could just digress a little bit. Because one of the things that I also have done is I've gone with different, there's different church groups that are in different places, and I'll go with one of the members of the church and they'll take me around to the different little farms. And then many people can understand some English, I can speak a little Nepali, and together we make it work. But there's usually somebody that's a little better translator with me in these places. So this one young gentleman came with me, and we're going to different spots. And so we get to this one place, and we looked at a goat, and the farmer said they were a little skinny, and I asked about the feed, and we talked about that and how to keep the pens cleaner and keep the feed off the ground for reduction of parasites would be a big step. So that was it. We get to the next one, and there's this doe that's standing over there by the house, by the barn or the shed, and the farmer is talking to my translator, and the guy says to me, okay, this doe doesn't have any babies, she won't have babies for the farmer. And so I'm not a veterinarian per se, but I certainly have seen a lot of animals, and I looked at her, and just from a physical standpoint, she looked healthy, she looked fine, everything looked intact that I could see from external side. Mm-hmm. And she was about 2.5 years old. So I said, well, where's the buck? And the guy kind of back and forth, and he shuffled his feet, the farmer, and he told the guy, well, the buck and doe were here, but as the buck grew older and they had the pen right next to the house, his wife didn't like the smell of the buck. So they had a festival in October, and the buck was 9 months old, and they had the buck for the festival, and the doe is there. And I said to the farmer, okay, you have 3 children. Now, did your wife have those 3 children by herself? He said, no. And I said, okay, well, that doe can't either. And I said, I'll tell you what, though. Here's what we can do. Your neighbor down the way has a nice buck. And what you're going to do is, so that your wife isn't offended by the smell, we're going to make a buck rag. And we're going to tie it on the fence. And when your doe switches her tail and starts to rub against that buck rag and all those little signs, and she's meh, you take her down to your neighbor and they can dance together, and then 5 months later she can have her babies. And he goes, oh. So anyway, I went back the next year, and I went to that farm, and I looked at the farmer, and he goes, Dan, they danced. And there were 2 little kids in the pen. So, aww, you know, it was just a one way of just kind of like translating it in a meaningful way, that, you know, they could.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So anyway, that was my fault.
Oh, I love it. It's great. Now, speaking of the goats and everything, one of the things that we all as goat enthusiasts love are goat swag. You know, the t-shirts, home decor, and right. especially those stuffed goats that you bring back. We know you brought to market these adorable stuffed goats, and they were made by the women in Nepal. How did that come about?
That came about is that I was talking to a friend one time in Nepal, and I was just telling about what I do and whatnot. And this happened to be a person who was from the U.S. And they said that they did farmers markets when they were home. They did, and so they said, oh, my gosh, I have all these people that are asking me at my little booth I have, do you have anything, like, these are just like people who are coming by, do you have any little goats? We like goats. And so she said, I have all these questions for goats. She goes, does your project make goats? And I said, at this point, I don't have them, but let me think about that. And I had already been to, this was in Kathmandu. Okay. I was already up in Pokhara many years ago because of that's where I started with seeing my friend, Paul Gay, the colonel. And they have a lot of little craft places up there. So I got on the bus and a couple of days later and went up to Pokhara and started going down the streets looking at their craft shops. And I came upon this one place that had a really nice store and all these women were in there. And they had this really beautiful product. They had purses and all kinds of different things. And so I looked, and on the shelf, they had elephants and giraffes. And I said, oh, you make little stuffed animals. Do you have goats? I thought this would be perfect here. They got these little animals, and they were using the textiles that they had woven from the cloth there, cotton that they had gotten. Everything was all from Nepal. Mm-hmm. And I said, you don't even have giraffes in Nepal. You don't have any goats? No, we don't know how to do goats. And I said, well, where are these made? And they said, oh, we have a place right up the street. And so they told me where it was, and I found it, and it was called this Woman Skills Development Organization, WSDO. And I met the person who ran that place. Her name was Rama. And Ram was just a wonderful lady. She had been running this place since 1975, had gotten all these awards for being a women's empowerment person and women's business entrepreneur internationally, and had this little row of single-story rooms. And I looked in these rooms, and here are these women. They're all women that work there. And they're singing, and they have these sewing machines, and they have these looms, and they're weaving, and each room is a different kind of an operation. There's some that are sewing, some are weaving, some are carding. But they were just talking and singing, and it was clean and beautiful, and I just went, oh, my God. They had all this colored yarn hanging from the racks drying. And I said, I got to have you make these goats for me. And so they said, well, talk to our designer. So it was Miss Madam.
Okay.
I met Miss Madam, and I went, okay, Miss Madam, what are we going to do here? And she goes, I don't know how to do a goat. So I showed her some pictures of my goats, mm-hmm. and I said, oh, look, let's start with this giraffe. So we're going to take the giraffe, we're going to lower the neck, we're going to do this and that. And anyway, so she would work with me for 3 days, and we came up with a prototype, and then we added horns and a beard because I wanted to do Kari as the first one since that was the national goat.
Right.
Indigenous goat. And so she made this up, and I saw it, and I just went, oh, my gosh. And so then that was the first grouping, was just the Kari. And then I came back, and we designed the Nubians and the La Manchas and the Swiss and the John Manapari, and it was just great. And so over the years, what's really been wonderful is I do the same thing with them. They make the goats that I have helped them design, but they do the product. And then I pay them a fair trade market price that they would sell it normally for. And then I end up having them shipped here. I pay customs and shipping. And so it comes out that on each goat, I give a profit margin of $5. So I make $5 once I pay them, pay the shipping, pay the customs. The $5 goes into the fund that I take back to Nepal, and I buy goats. And so that I then give to the village women. And so when I talked to Miss Rama about this, She goes, oh my gosh, it's a win-win for everybody. We get the goats and we sell them to you. You give them to your friends so they get a goat. And then you come back and give our people another goat. So I say, give a goat, get a goat. Give a goat. That's my term. But I've gotten them sewing machines. They had a fire a couple years ago, and through some support of some generous donors and myself, we were able to buy them new looms so they could keep producing not only the goats, but other crafts that they do. And she has 500 women that work with her, either 100 on site or piecemeal at home. And wow. It's a wonderful, wonderful operation. And it's so uplifting when you go there and just see it and see them working. And when I come by now, they go, there's the goat man. Oh, Dan.
And, oh, I love anyway, that.
That's how that's come about. And it's just been a real pleasant experience working with them, for sure.
It's awesome.
And that is just really awesome.
You know, so they win. It just is, it's, yeah. So that's how that came about. And we've got the cards, the little greeting cards that we do now as well. And that was thanks to Miss Mary Thompson from Minnesota. She visited one time in Nepal with Jennifer Roman. And they started this aspect of teaching the kids about doing greeting cards. And that became a part of this whole process as well. So it's like, it's really a, it's just a, it's like one of these little rippling things. It's a team effort. And while I call it a one-man band, I'm far from being a one-man band. I have all this tremendous support across the whole United States, believe me. And I feel it and I appreciate it so much.
It's awesome. The whole project is just beautiful, right?
You know, Tommy, it's really a funny thing, but you know, I don't know how to explain this, but the best I can do is this. When something is like right, it's just right. And I don't know. It's just this like, and I'm just a part of this whole thing. I mean, it's like, I started it, but it's like, it's bigger than me. And it's just, but it's just right. I mean, that's all I can say. You know, it's just, I go to the villages and I see what's going on with the goats now and the people. And it's just so, you know, uplifting to see actually traction happening. And I look at it as I'm giving them a hand up, not a handout, because as we all know, education is one of the most valuable gifts you can give to anybody, and knowledge of whatever it is, knowledge of our goats, knowledge of how to do this. And so that doesn't cost a dime. And that's what I can give freely to all of them. And that's what I really try to have them then want to do for others, to uplift them so that they can uplift others. And it just is a chain reaction. And I see it. I see it happening in the villages all the time. These women that they're like models then for their village. And if they start doing well, then the other village people, let's go see what, you know, I mean, so it takes, when it's a good thing and positive, it just takes on a life of its own and expands.
No, that's just an amazing kind of idea. And I know we talked about the impact earlier, but I think the impact, I mean, even just not even in Nepal, but what you have brought back to all of us in the United States and probably beyond too, from your travels, from these, from the stories and from those little goats, you know, it just extends and extends.
Yeah. One thing I just want to touch upon in that whole vein, if I could, is our youth. And that is something that, like, that's part of what I really wanted to get into the schools over there, because of being the teacher. I love our youth and value mm-hmm. them very much wherever. And something that just happened along those lines that I cannot tell you how much it just meant to me. I was, you know, most of my days are pretty good. I was having a pretty decent day, but all of a sudden it was with this goats. I got this little email from a young lady in South Carolina, and she said she wanted to get one of the goats that I had just posted pictures of. And I said, well, I've got this one or that one. And she goes, oh, I just want a colorful one. And I said, well, there's a red one. And she says, oh, that'll be perfect. So I sent it to her and she wrote me back and she goes, I don't know if you remember or not, but 10 years ago, when I was 11 years old, you judged me in showmanship And I knew that you'd been to Nepal, and I didn't know where it was. And I asked you in the ring about Nepal, and you talked to me about it and told me where it was and stuff like that. And she goes, I was looking at up later, but she goes, after the show was over, you came over to me and you had some coins from Nepal, and you gave me those coins from Nepal, and I have them to this day. And oh, wow. It was the nicest thing that had happened to me by a judge. And I wanted to cry. I mean, yeah. And so she said, now I've got my goat and I can feel I'm a part of the whole thing too. And I just went, wow, how can you put,
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the kind of things that I am fortunate to have come my way.
Yeah. I mean, I have one last question regarding everything that you do and the awesomeness that is Dan Laney. And that is, how can listeners help out if they are so inclined?
Well, number one, one of the things is that it doesn't cost a dime. It's just saying, hey, good job, Dan. Keep it up. I appreciate just the words of encouragement, because that is something that's so important for all of us. And I'm certainly one of those too. So, if you see me and you see me at a show or something, just saying, hey, really appreciate getting your photos, knowing about what you're doing and whatever it could be. So that kind of a thing. The second thing, of course, is again, through the purchase of these little goats. It's a long haul to get to a big goat by selling them, but it's just a really nice little, they make great gifts. They're a really good thing. So somebody that would like to have a goat, they can certainly get them in several ways. Number one, they can go through this site that should be up soon, if it's not up now, by that same lady that I talked about who had the trade fairs. And it's Kali Madu, KALIMANDU.com. KaliMandu.com. And she has those goats in the story about Worldwide Goat Project on her site. She just came back from Nepal herself, so she was working on getting it back up. I believe it is. If okay. not, they can just text me, Facebook, email. I have goats as well. I'd be glad to have them. If I have one that trips their trigger, I certainly would be glad to send it to them. Another way that they could just help is that one of the companies that's been really supportive for me and the project over the years is Caprine Supply. And so I do take hoof trimmers and certain small tools over to Nepal with me when I go on trips and medications. And some people have generously gotten a gift certificate that they've put at Caprine Supply for me to then use to acquire whatever I need to take over to Nepal. So that's another way, a gift certificate through Caprine Supply. Greg is just wonderful about holding that for me. And then, of course, just reaching out to me and contacting me, I would certainly appreciate any support anybody would like to offer. And that's just another way they can do it. Again, through my email, which is Laney Los Lunas, LaneyLosLunas, at AOL.com. Or even just questions, more information. Yeah. I'd be glad to just try to answer anything. But like I said, just what this is right here, this podcast, getting the word out, just showing how connected we are around the world and how much goats have been that thread of connection for all of us. It's incredible.
It certainly is incredible. And I'll be sure to link all of that, the website, your email, everything on the show notes. So we'll get that all in one spot for anybody that's listening and wants to just have an easy click. We'll guide you there. It really is an impressive project that you have going on. Your life is impressive. I'm super happy that I've been able to meet you in person, and I can't wait to see you again. I mean, you're an incredible guy.
Well, I don't know. I think we ought to end there, John. I'm just really. I tell you what, you guys all mean so much to me. It's right back at you. It's right back at you, because what you're doing and what all these everywhere, all across the country, I just feel so lucky to see these people who are, putting on the shows, showing their animals, doing all that. But this podcast and other people, gosh, my hat's off to you. This is what keeps us uplifted and going and being the wonderful people that we have met in the goat world. I mean, it's just awesome. I just like to be one of those little positive cogs in that whole big wheel. And
you're definitely positive. That's for sure.
I'll keep doing my best, John. I'll tell you that, Danielle. Thank you both. Thank you both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, no, this was definitely our pleasure. I will speak for myself and then speak for John as well. Sorry, John, but this was such a informative conversation, and I knew that, you know, I knew what you were doing in Nepal, but just didn't realize the true extent of what it really was that you were doing and the work. And I mean, we talked about it again and again, but just the impact that is a worldwide impact. And so it was just a pleasure to take this time. And we so appreciate your time sitting and talking about this with us today.
Well, agreed.
Thank you. And hey, listen, maybe we could have a second one here in another month another year or two.
Listen, you are, like I said, you're ADCA's sweetheart. So that will definitely, no question about it, we will definitely want you back on. Now,
a few other little stories I could share.
For sure.
Thank you. Well, what can we do here? I don't want to.
Yeah. So, Danielle, we have a little bit of housekeeping as far as some news and where people can find us.
Yes. So, first thing really quick is we appreciate all of the comments that were posted related to my April Fool's Day prank, which I think almost ultimately backfired on me, because I feel like the goat world and our lovely ringside listeners are all going to now, for better or for worse, be influenced by the ringside stylings of some footwear. And so we are in the works. The merchandise store should be launched. It may even be launched before this episode airs. It just kind of depends on a few things on our end, kind of the backside of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be flip-flops. And I am working on getting some Crocs for all of our friends who are
Tyler.
Tyler Big T. So disclaimer to the world, this is not, like, they may be ringside Crocs, but this is, I don't know if this will be like a ringside style endorsed product, because I don't necessarily know if we want to be crocking, but we're listening to everybody and we're working on
nothing wrong with some Crocs. Hey,
I know. But there will also be t-shirts and hoodies and a few other things that'll come out of that store. So it'll be launched. If it doesn't get launched this week, it'll probably be launched within the next couple of weeks. So we're just really excited about that. And that'll be found on our website at www.dairygoatpodcast.com. And we look forward to having it there for you all.
Yeah, there's probably three W's there, but you know.
Oh, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, dairygoatpodcast.com. We'll hopefully have that launched up. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, all of the podcast services. We would really appreciate if you like the podcast, or if you don't like the podcast, you can go on there and leave us a review. We'd love to hear feedback. We love our community. And join us in the conversation. So that being said, first of all, Dan Laney, thank you so much for being on again. It's been a pleasure. We really appreciate you. And for everybody else, this has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
And we'll catch you on the next one. Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.